Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I just spoke with the Prime Minister of Israel and Lebanon. I'm pleased to announce that their governments have accepted the United States proposal to end the devastating conflict between Israel and Hezbollah.
Thousands of displaced residents of southern Lebanon are returning home to find scenes of devastation after a ceasefire came into effect earlier today. We'll get the latest, then speak to Israeli journalist Gideon Levy of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which has just been sanctioned by the Israeli government as they cut off all communication with the Israeli paper. We'll also speak to ACLU attorney Chase Strangio. Next week, he'll become the first openly trans attorney to argue before the Supreme Court. We'll talk about the case and congressional Republican attacks on Sarah McBride after she was elected as the first openly trans member of Congress. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah has begun. Under the deal, Israel will withdraw troops from South Lebanon over a 60-day period, with Hezbollah moving its fighters and weapons to north of the Litani River. Lebanese troops plan to deploy to the south, which has been largely destroyed by 14 months of Israeli attacks. In a joint statement, the U.S. and France said, quote, "This announcement will create the conditions to restore lasting calm and allow residents in both countries to return safely to their homes," unquote. Thousands of displaced residents of South Lebanon are returning home to find scenes of devastation. On Tuesday, Israel kept bombing the region, as well as Beirut, until just before the ceasefire took effect. Over the past 14 months, Israel's killed over 3,800 people in Lebanon, displaced more than a million. Israel has not yet urged residents displaced in northern Israel to return to their homes. Many question how long the cessation of hostilities will last. On Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened to keep attacking Lebanon if Hezbollah violates the deal.
The length of the ceasefire depends on what happens in Lebanon. In full cooperation with the United States, we retain complete military freedom of action. Should Hezbollah violate the agreement or attempt to rearm, we will strike.
In Gaza, Israel struck a school in Gaza City, killing at least 13 displaced Palestinians who'd sought shelter in the Zaytun neighborhood. Dozens were wounded in the attack. An Israeli airstrike on a home in the same neighborhood killed another 7 people. Meanwhile, the United Nations reports this year is already the deadliest on record for aid workers, largely due to Israel's war on Gaza. This is Lisa Doten of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Since 7 October, more than 330 humanitarian workers have lost their lives. Most of them were UNRWA staff. Some are with their families in their homes. Others were at work in UNRWA offices and shelters. These numbers signal a disturbing lack of regard for the lives of civilians and humanitarian and UN workers. There's no situation in recent history that compares.
President-elect Trump has tapped his former chief economist, Kevin Hassett, to lead the National Economic Council. Hassett helped craft the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which massively redistributed wealth to the richest 1% of Americans, including Trump's family and members of his administration. In 2020, Hassett argued COVID lockdowns should be lifted, predicting zero deaths from the disease by May 15th of that year. In fact, the CDC reported more than 350,000 U.S. COVID deaths in 2020. Meanwhile, Trump has tapped Stanford University health economist Dr. Jay Bhattacharya to lead the National Institutes of Health. In 2020, he was a main author of the Great Barrington Declaration, which argued against COVID lockdowns at a time when no vaccines were available. Instead, Bhattacharya said COVID should be allowed to spread without mitigation in order to create so-called herd immunity. The World Health Organization called the unprecedented plan scientifically and ethically problematic, saying it would result in far more unnecessary infections, suffering, and death. Trump has nominated Jamison Greer to serve as the next U.S. trade representative. During Trump's first term, Greer played a key role in imposing tariffs on China and other nations. He also helped with negotiations over the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, which replaced NAFTA. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum has blasted Donald Trump's pledge to impose a 25% tariff on imports from Canada and Mexico, threatening retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. On Tuesday, President Sheinbaum read publicly from her letter to Trump, warning of dire economic consequences if a U.S. trade war, including massive job losses and higher prices on everything from food to electronics to automobiles. Sheinbaum also took aim at Trump's claims of a so-called invasion of asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border, who Trump claims are bringing drugs like fentanyl into the United States.
70% of the illegal weapons seized from criminals in Mexico come from your country. We do not produce these weapons, nor do we consume synthetic drugs. Tragically, it is in our country that people are being killed by crimes resulting from demand in your country.
In Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott Tuesday signaled strong cooperation between state and federal law enforcement during a Thanksgiving dinner event in the border town on Edinburgh. Abbott was joined by incoming U.S. Border Czar Tom Homan, who helped serve meals to Texas state troopers and National Guard members. Separately, Texas Land Commissioner Don Buckingham on Tuesday offered the incoming Trump administration the use of up to 13 million acres of Texas land to stage mass deportations. Buckingham spoke from a Starr County ranch in the Rio Grande Valley, where Texas is currently constructing a section of border wall.
I have extended an offer to President Trump and incoming border czar Tom Homan to use this 1,400-acre property to construct a facility for the processing, detention, and coordination efforts of what will be the largest deportation of violent criminals in our nation's history.
Meanwhile, U.S. agricultural industry groups are calling on the incoming Trump administration to exempt farm workers from mass deportation, arguing Trump's promise to expel millions of undocumented immigrants from the U.S. would devastate their sector. An estimated 1 million farm, dairy, and meatpacking workers are undocumented. In business news, Walmart, the nation's largest private employer, has announced plans to roll back DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, and close its Center for Racial Equity, which was created after the police killing of George Floyd. In addition, Walmart plans to block third parties from selling certain LGBTQ-themed items on its website. Walmart will also no longer use the terms DEI and Latinx in official communications. The move comes just weeks after Donald Trump was elected after campaigning against DEI initiatives. And news from Pakistan. Security forces in Islamabad arrested over 1,000 protesters in a massive crackdown targeting supporters of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who'd marched on the capital city. At least 6 people died in the protests that began Sunday. Khan's supporters had vowed to stage a sit-in until he was released, but they ended the protests following the security crackdown. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control says a California child has become the first U.S. minor to become infected with H5N1 bird flu. The source of the infection is not yet known, but investigators do not believe the child had contact with an infected animal. This follows the weeks-long hospitalization of a Canadian teenager in British Columbia who remains critically ill with an H5N1 infection. Viral genome sequences from the teen revealed mutations that might improve the virus's ability to spread among human hosts. H5N1 has spread rapidly through U.S. factory farms, mostly affecting poultry before it was discovered in cattle in March. It's since spread to at least 600 herds and has caused infections in dairy and poultry workers. The California Department of Public Health recently detected H5N1 in a sample of raw milk sold in California. President-elect Trump's nominee for health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has promised to lift restrictions on unpasteurized milk and has claimed there are no vaccines that are safe and effective. Infectious disease expert Dr. Michael Mina recently wrote bird flu could become the next pandemic, warning, quote, if H5N1 bird flu continues to expand to human transmission, the history books will not look kindly upon the U.S. early efforts to contain it when we absolutely could have taken much more aggressive and clear action, unquote. And lawmakers in the United Kingdom advanced legislation to create a smoke-free generation. Under the Tobacco and Vapes Bill, anyone born after January 1st, 2009 would not be legally allowed to purchase cigarettes. The bill would also ban advertisements promoting vapes and would restrict vapes with flavors that appeal to young people. A recent study predicts tobacco use will cause 300,000 cases of cancer over the next 5 years in the UK alone. On Tuesday, British Health Secretary Wes Streeting argued in favor of the bill during debate in the House of Commons.
Smoking takes 80,000 lives a year, causes one in four deaths from cancer in England, a hospital admission almost every minute, 100 GP appointments an hour. It is the leading cause of sickness, disability and death in our country. And today, members in this House can consign it to the history books.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, we look at the new ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. Stay with us.
ورميت المرسى بمواني السبع بحار يما كأني بعدني بنفس المكان وجداني وهمومي لسه جوا الدار
I will return, Yo-Yo Ma, Mashru Leila, and Narsi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Thousands of displaced residents of southern Lebanon are returning home to find scenes of devastation after a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah came into effect earlier today. In the hours before the cessation of hostilities, Israel repeatedly struck areas of Beirut in southern Lebanon. Under the deal, Israel will withdraw troops from Lebanon's south over a 60-day period, while Hezbollah will move its fighters and weapons to north of the Litani River. Lebanese troops will redeploy to the south. In a joint statement, the U.S. and France said, quote, this announcement will create the conditions to restore lasting calm and allow residents in both countries to return safely to their homes, unquote. Lebanon's caretaker prime minister, Najib Mikati, spoke earlier today.
Truly, it is a new day, concluding one of the most difficult stages of suffering that the Lebanese have experienced in their modern history. It actually was the most harsh as well as hopeful. On this day, the 1,000-mile journey begins to rebuild what was destroyed and to complete strengthening the role of legitimate institutions, at the forefront of which is the army, on which we place great hopes to extend the state's authority over the whole nation and strengthen its presence in the wounded south.
Over the past 14 months, Israel's killed over 3,800 people in Lebanon and displaced more than a million. Israel also killed the entire leadership of Hezbollah, including Hassan Nasrallah and two of his successors. Hezbollah rocket attacks on northern Israel forced tens of thousands of Israelis to flee their homes. We're joined now by two guests. In Tel Aviv, in Israel, we're joined by Gideon Levy. award-winning Israeli journalist, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, where he's a member of its editorial board. His latest book, The Killing of Gaza, reports on a catastrophe. And in Montreal, Canada, Lina Munzer is with us, Lebanese writer, senior editor of the arts and literature magazine, The Markaz Review. You know, I remember just after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, Lina, you were in our studio here, and you wrote about what it was like to see an attack on your country from afar, what it meant. Talk about the significance of the ceasefire now.
I mean, of course, you know, it's a welcome relief for the entire country to have this ceasefire. At the same time, it leaves so much devastation behind, you know. And you spoke about in the last hours, the Israelis continued bombing up until. I'm not sure that that conveys the level of barbarism. I mean, they were essentially carpet bombing, you know, the south and Beirut and hitting all kinds of targets and, you know, absolutely indiscriminately. You know, Israelis always talk about targeted attacks and people buy this, and it's reported even that, you know, when innocent civilians die, it's usually as a collateral damage to these targeted attacks. And of course, there have been targeted assassinations. We've seen them already. The idea that, you know, that civilians are acceptable collateral damage to this kind of targeted assassination is already just a completely outrageous idea. But, you know, yesterday in the final hours of the ceasefire, I had a dear friend who lost his elderly parents. There was absolutely no warning, and they were targeted directly in their apartment. And based on essentially, I suppose, erroneous AI information. And this is something that has happened to countless families over the course of these last 14 months. It was especially difficult. You know, I am in Montreal, but I was speaking to friends throughout the day. I was hearing the airstrikes. People were terrified. People were running on foot. There was absolutely no safe place to hide. It was truly like, you know, at 24 hours that were just condensed horror. And it is absolute terrorism. It is barbarism. I don't have any other words to describe it. And so there's a lot of relief now as we go into the ceasefire. At the same time, there's a lot of apprehension because we're not sure how long it's going to last. It feels like a very fragile truce, essentially. And also, you know, people are coming back not just to devastated homes and devastated lands in the south, but they're picking up the pieces of their lost, you know, families. There are a lot of people now who are going to be able to have funerals that they weren't able to have, memorials that they weren't able to have. You know, the grieving process begins now, not just for the country at large, but specifically for so many families who have lost their loved ones, including up until these final 24 hours. So yes, there is relief, but there's also a lot of apprehension and just an incredible amount of grief, you know. People are finding it very difficult to celebrate. A lot of people that I spoke to just said, I have no energy to do anything today but just sit and cry, you know. So it is, again, very, very mixed feelings around this. But of course, a lot of relief, just at least that the killing is over, because it was just, it was just barbaric.
And Lina, what do we know about the terms of this ceasefire or truce? And we've heard from Netanyahu and Biden, but Hezbollah has been silent until now. What do we know about their perspective?
I think Hezbollah spoke about it earlier. They did not release statements after after the U.S. and Israel released their statements. They had kind of, they had spoken earlier just in agreeing essentially to this truce already. So I think that that was the statement that they gave, you know, that spoke on their behalf essentially. What we know about, you know, I've heard so many different things about the terms of this truce, and I've read many different things. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure because there's so many contradictory things. But from what I read, yes, there is this idea that the Israelis are now going to withdraw over 60 days their troops. I mean, already they've been, people are going, flocking to the south to just see the destruction. And the Israelis have been threatening, you know, since yesterday that it's not safe to return to the south. You're not allowed to return until we tell you to return. So already, you know, this idea that there's going to be a restoration of some kind of, you know, Lebanese sovereignty over the land. This is already being contradicted by the behavior and the directives of the Israeli army. And, you know, essentially also what I've read and what I've seen is that Israel has the right to violate Lebanese sovereignty at any moment. So should they decide that there is excuse enough. And, you know, when Israel acts with the impunity that we've seen it act with, and we know that it has the absolute full backing of the United States, it's also very difficult to feel safe as a Lebanese person or to feel that this the terms of this truth are a truce are in any way safe, you know, or in any way provide some sense of security, because you know that at any point they can use any excuse that they like, and it will be accepted. You know, it will be accepted. There's nothing that we can say on the world stage that is going to prevent violation, further violation, further carpet bombing. So there really is a sense of being completely exposed, you know, before the world and having no political recourse, essentially being at the mercy of these larger powers, which, you know, they have demonstrated again and again their brutality over the last 14 months, not just in Lebanon, but much more largely in Gaza.
I want to bring Gideon Levy into this conversation in Tel Aviv. Gideon, if you could start off by responding to, there was a latest text from the Israeli negotiator Gershon Baskin, who wrote, "The ceasefire agreement, which went into effect today, is good news. The agreement is between Israel and the government of Lebanon, not between Israel and Hezbollah. It seems that Hezbollah has been weakened enough." It says, it seems that it's been weakened enough that, let's see if I can find this, that it's been weakened enough to end the war in Lebanon before the war in Gaza has ended. Your response to this, and also the response in Israel right now to, I think it was about 4 a.m. that the ceasefire or the cessation of hostilities went into effect.
Yes, I wish I could tell you that Israel is happy about the ceasefire. I wish I could tell you that there is even a relief in Israel. But unfortunately, in Israel, almost everyone is critical about this agreement. I guess many Israelis did not have enough. For sure, the right-wingers, for sure, the most of the inhabitants of the north, they would like to see more blood and more destruction in Lebanon. And therefore, they are so sour today. And the other camp, as usual, is saying nothing. And even one of the opposition leaders, Benny Gantz, even criticized the ceasefire. He thought the war should go on. In other words, Israel wants wars. That's the inevitable conclusion when you see reactions to a ceasefire which puts an end, at least partial end, to suffer in both sides, suffer which didn't lead to anywhere. Israel didn't achieve anything in this war. It will not achieve anything in the war in Gaza, which is 10 times or 1,000 times worse. And here I must emphasize that nobody should have any illusions. Netanyahu has no intention to put an end to the war in Gaza. What happened in Lebanon will not happen soon in Gaza, because if he goes for an agreement in Gaza, he loses his government, and that's his top priority. And Israel, at least part of Israel, has very serious intentions to resettle Gaza. Don't underestimate those settlers. The sky's the limit for them. They just wait for Donald Trump to get into the office. And I will not be surprised if we'll very soon later see settlements in Gaza. In other words, nothing was solved yesterday except of the punishment of Lebanon, which came to its end. But also this is for a very limited time. I mean, when the prime minister speaks about the agreement, and all he has to say are threats about Lebanon and Hezbollah, that if any violation will take place, immediately Israel will attack again. So we are going from one war to the other, and from one violent confrontation to the other without even suggesting any other alternative. Nothing. Nobody speaks about diplomacy. Nobody speaks about touching the core issues, both in the North and in the South. Our friend from Lebanon, our Lebanese friend, just mentioned violations of the sovereignty of Lebanon. Anyone speaks about the fact that Israel, I'm sure, will continue to fly over Lebanon for intelligence. This will be kosher. This will be legitimate. And only the violation of Israeli sovereignty is never forgiven.
And Gideon Levy, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the toll on the IDF now, over 800 soldiers have been killed in Gaza. About the estimates are about 73 or 74 in Lebanon, and those are the only ones publicly acknowledged. What is the impact on Israel of continuing this war on the economy of Israel, on migration, on tourism, and the other aspects of economic life in Israel?
The price is enormous, but somehow Israeli accepted. This is this unbelievable phenomena in which people are ready to sacrifice the dearest ones. I mean, who is more than your son? Without seeing a real purpose. I mean, they all tell themselves that they were killed, sacrificed for the defense of Israel. But what kind of defense is it if you bomb a camp in Gaza? What does Israel benefit out of it? The economical price is one thing. I mean, you mentioned tourism. There is no tourism whatsoever. There are hardly any international airlines to fly in here. But there is a much heavier price, namely turning Israel into a pariah state. You know it very well from the United States, but everywhere else. It's not only that Netanyahu and the Gallant are now wanted all over the world. Every Israeli will feel it when he will go abroad now. Every Israelis everywhere will feel at least discomfort in the presenting himself, identifying himself as an Israeli. And still Israelis are ready to take this only because they were told that we have to live from war, to live on our sword, and there is no other option, which is a total lie because Israel never tried an alternative. But brainwash like brainwash.
Gideon, I don't know if you can respond to this, but the Israeli cabinet has unanimously voted to sanction your paper, Haaretz, saying its editorials, quote, have hurt the legitimacy of the state of Israel and its right to self-defense, unquote. Under the move, the Israeli government will stop advertising in the paper, cut off all communications with Haaretz. Haaretz has slammed the decision, saying it, quote, is another step in Netanyahu's journey to dismantle Israeli democracy. Like his friends Putin, Erdogan, Orban, Netanyahu is trying to silence a critical independent newspaper. Haaretz will not balk and will not morph into a government pamphlet that publishes messages approved by the government and its leader. Unquote. This all comes 6 months after Israel banned Al Jazeera from operating in Israel. And as the president-elect here in the United States, Donald Trump threatens to go after major U.S. broadcasters and publications, calling the media the enemy of the people. Gideon, you serve on the editorial board of Haaretz. I know you can't speak specifically about the sanctions against your paper, but can you talk broader about these threats to the press?
Sure. It's not that I can't, but we decided that this message that you just read now is our reaction as a newspaper. But I think that those sanctions tell much more about Israel and Israel's government than about the Haaretz. And here, I think especially in the United States, who always speaks about the shared values, about the only democracy in the Middle East. So, first of all, it's questionable if a state which rules in such a brutal way in 5 million people can at all be defined as a democracy. But let's put the occupation and the apartheid aside. Even for us Jews in Israel, who used to live in a quite liberal democracy, things are changing right now, from day to day, from week to week, legislations against freedom of speech, against the legal system, against any kind of human rights, against any minority are being ruled, and nobody says a word. I mean, nobody can stop it, at least as long as this government is there. So what I would like to stress here, Amy, is that you have to also look at what's going on within the Jewish Israel. It is changing while we are speaking. And the war in Gaza and Lebanon has a lot to do with it, because those two wars, with all their lack of legitimacy and brutality, also influence the domestic structure and the domestic system of Israel, and you see the outcome.